Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm delighted to be in the garden with Julia Samuel. Julia was a Guinness, and she was descended from Sam Guinness, who was brother of Arthur Guinness, who founded the brewery in the 1700s. She is from the banking line of the Guinnesses. Her twin brother is Hugo Guinness, and she has twin sisters Miranda and Sabrina, and then Anita's in the middle, who is the widow of Amschel Rothschild. Now, Julia is extremely well known as a psychotherapist and is author of bestseller Grief Works, and she has a podcast, Therapy Works, and his godmother to Prince George. Julia, it's fabulous to have you on the podcast. I haven't seen you, I don't think, since your mother's funeral. But a lot has happened since I probably knew you better when I first met my husband, who is your first cousin.
He's my first cousin.
Yeah, that's right. And your parents kindly would ask us to have a holiday with them in the south of France.
And Kevin came on childhood holidays with us to Portugal, to Malta. I remember him very well as a child, yeah.
Oh, do you? Because I went to see Hugo maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I asked him about his relationship with Kevin, and it was really funny because he said, well, they brought Kevin in because with all those girls, the sister, they wanted a manly influence. Kevin totally denies that that was the reason. But, and he said once he shot me in the bottom with his air rifle. And I asked Kevin about this, and he said, well, he was so annoying. But I suppose there was sort of a 7-year difference between you and Hugo and Kevin. So he was the older relative, really.
He was. I mean, obviously as a child, I didn't know why he was asked, except that it was really lovely to have someone else in the family and to kind of create a different dynamic within the family, having Kevin there. I remember him being quite shy. I remember him not saying that much.
Yeah.
But I also remember him having quite a powerful presence. He has quite a powerful presence, Kevin.
Yeah.
And, you know, in retrospect, particularly as someone who specialises in grief, I recognise that my mum had her brother and sister die, so she had nieces and nephews who didn't have a parent, and Kevin's dad, my father's brother, had died. So now looking back, I'm assuming that Kevin was asked because he wanted to stay close to him, and in a way to stay close to his brother, who he'd really loved, Ivan, although it had been quite a complicated relationship.
So James, your father, had really got on well with Ivan?
Well, my understanding of it, and every family, everybody within a family has a different story, and so all my siblings would probably say something different. Kevin is probably the most likely to know the truth. But my understanding was that Ivan was very naughty.
Yeah, we got that. Very naughty.
And
yes.
Broke lots of rules. And my dad was sort of good and more shy and better behaved. But the way my dad talked about him, I can remember more the tone of his voice, was that he kind of always quite looked up to him for being naughty. And certainly we as children, and Hugo, my twin brother, were always applauded for being naughty because it kind of showed that you were brave. And I think that could have come from Uncle Ivan.
Right. No, I find this whole thing fascinating because he was the favourite son. I don't know if you got that Ivan, the naughty Ivan, was revered for being so naughty. And they used to be very sociable, the grandparents, didn't they?
Gaga, my grandmother.
Yes, and lots of parties. And Ivan would go and drink all the leftovers in the glasses and the half leftovers. And Pam, their sister, said that one day he had so much alcohol, aged about 12, that he passed out for 2 days.
Oh my God.
And they thought that was hilarious. And then when he died at 26 of sclerosis of the liver,
you know, in the dentist chair, wasn't it?
It was in the dentist chair.
It was a mixture of anaesthetic and having cirrhosis.
No, well, a friend of Kevin's mother was on the post-mortem and it was sclerosis of the liver.
At 26.
I mean,
that's the first I've heard that.
Yeah, that is just amazing. So he was, whether he would have been a natural addict or whether it was sort of pushed upon him, but certainly Kevin's mother was an addict. And she, all his life, she's been an alcoholic.
Yeah, Adley.
Age two or three, he'd see her in the bath, passed out.
I remember seeing her drunk.
Do I pull the plug out or do I leave in the cold bath? And living awful. On a diet of cornflakes and Ribena yeah. and things. And someone said to him, a doctor when he was about 15, no, you'll be an alcoholic, both your parents are. You will be too, sort of thing. I'm not sure why any doctor would say that to an adolescent, but anyway, he isn't, thank goodness. So, yeah. But it's extraordinary growing up with these things, isn't it? I mean, Kevin thinks it's perfectly normal, and he says he is an introvert, and I think when he came to stay with you, you were five lively children, yes. And I think he would have been quiet because he yeah. would never known that level of noise.
Yeah. I was very quiet.
Yeah, I remember you were the quiet, you were definitely the one with the work ethic. When I came to stay with you age 16, 17, I remember all your sisters and Hugo were very entertaining, lively and larking around, and you were definitely the one with the work ethic.
Yes,
and that was
right.
Whether you were just born, I sometimes think people are either born with a work ethic or they become like that. I don't know, but
I mean, for me, it gave me structure and it gave me safety.
Yes.
So it gave me a feeling of control, being born into a family that was as loving and, you know, great as it was also quite chaotic and unpredictable.
Yeah.
And so I remember deciding that, you know, really quite young, at about 8, that I worked. And I remember asked my mother to buy me a desk to do homework, and I took her down to Kensington High Street to buy a little desk that I've got here, actually, so that I had a proper desk that I took into my bedroom that I shared with my sister Anita rather than my twin brother. And
yeah.
So that I could have the order of my pencils and my pens and do my homework.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you developed a strategy at that age. I do remember that because you were the youngest and Hugo was the longed-for son and heir, highly amusing, that sometimes, I remember them taking your bikini top in the pool and hiding it when you were like 14 and being quite nasty, I thought, to you. And it was, they were strong personalities.
They were.
Very,
there were many things that were done to me.
Yes. So I can see that would be a good strategy to cope with it. Yeah. Mm. I find it slightly difficult, to be honest, because I think they adore Kevin, or they love, you know, they're very affectionate to Kevin, and I was this interloper, and perhaps wasn't too welcome.
So you met Kevin so young, you were 16.
Well, as you did your husband, yes, I moved in with him when I was still at school, which in those days,
good
in
God.
The 70s, well, my parents were going through a divorce, and they really didn't know whether I was coming or going, or they were coming or going, so it actually made life much easier, much more enjoyable and nicer. And I suppose that was my refuge. And it was just, I think, just thoroughly lucky to meet someone that you get on with at such a young age, isn't
really
it?
Lucky.
Did you find that? Or did you feel you were slightly weird to find someone so young and things? Because it was unusual, wasn't it?
It was unusual, yes. Less unusual than it is now.
Yeah.
So, but... I didn't feel weird. I mean, when I look back at it, I'm amazed. I thought I was old enough to know what I was doing because I was 20 when we got married and I moved out. I don't think I told my parents I was moving out. I think I moved out and I'm not sure they ever asked me had I gone.
Yeah, likewise.
Or discussed it.
Yeah, likewise.
Or had a conversation or anything. And then I told them I was getting married and they were delighted. Dad, like you said, one down, four to go. and so, I mean, it was a very different time where, you know, we were protected and looked after in lots of ways. But the idea of parenting was really a verb that came in the 70s. And
oh, was it?
And, you know, they had no knowledge of child development or mental health or secure attachment or any of those things. So, I got a lot of very good things from being with my siblings and my parents, for which I'm enormously grateful.
Yeah.
And there was quite a lot of chaos.
Yeah. And I always remember Pauline, your mum, she was such a wonderful hostess, wasn't she? She was very sociable, she knew everybody, she was always bubbly and lively. But what I hadn't realised was her drink problem. You see, I know she'd had one or two hiccups.
You didn't realise?
I knew the one or two hiccups, but compared to Kevin's mum, who would be, you know, ask people to dinner and fall flat on her face in the stew.
But mum did that.
Oh, did she?
Yes.
Maybe, yes. But Kevin's mother was totally unfunctioning alcoholic. Was your mother a functioning alcoholic?
No, she was pretty functioning. My mum was more of a binger.
As was Marie, yes. Yeah.
But she... So mum, I mean, she was very funny, my mother. Hugo's funny and he gets it a lot from her. I mean, she would go to AA in Hartley Whitney and be Lady Bountiful, really, and take digestive biscuits and share in AA. And then she'd go to Thresher's on the way home and buy a bottle of vodka. And so she was a teenager. She loved being naughty.
Yes.
A bit like Ivan. I mean, I'm sure that's why Dad was attracted to her. And so she was very naughty.
Yeah.
And continued to be naughty until the day she died at 90.
I always remember, yeah, seeing her later on in her later years. She was still had that spark.
She had a
twinkle.
Real spark, yeah.
Yeah.
She was really fun.
And effervescent, yes.
But a child.
But as a child, it's not so easy to live with.
And she was a child. She remained a child. I mean, she was very organised. So the day, you know, she would often cook lunch very early in the morning in the country at the weekends and put it in the warming drawer and then she'd get drunk, but lunch was already cooked.
Oh, right, I see. But they always say that, don't they? That if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, you are like children, because every time you have a problem in life, you learn how to cope with it. If you just take drink or drugs to solve the problem, then you never learn to cope. And so they often are, aren't they, emotionally quite
That's
immature.
True.
Yeah.
And also your development arrests at the time you develop your addiction.
Yeah, yes. Difficult times, but luckily you are not, and Kevin is not, and I have to say...
Well, I don't drink.
Yeah.
So I stopped drinking when I went to AA when I was 24.
Wow, that's
So
young.
I made a decision very early on to stop drinking.
So
you
would have been an addict.
I am an addict. Mm. I'm just an addict. I use it for work. I use it for all sorts of other things. I have the same propensity, but I do it in a way that doesn't mean I pass out.
Mm. So have they done experiments with identical twins that have the addict gene? And I mean, is it sort of very difficult to override? Because people always say it's an illness, and I'm sure it is. Is it a gene? And if you have it, unless you've got a very strong personality, as you obviously have, you are most likely to suffer from these cravings and addictions.
I mean, I think I'm sure there's more updated research. I mean, the last time I looked at it, there's research that came from the Royal Free, I think, that says you can have a predisposition to addiction.
Yes.
So that your genetic coding, your epigenetics from your parents and your grandparents, would give you a heightened sensitivity to being addictive. But always that is shaped by your environment, by what happens to you after you're born, because that is by far the most formative part, the 0 to 5 years. But also, you know, there's two ways of developing behaviors. It's epigenetics, so what you're born with, but also behaviors. So I was brought up to see that how you deal with difficulty is either passing out or shutting down. And I chose to be a therapist, which meant I learnt different tools. So, but I definitely have... But I think addiction is such an interesting subject, because I think, A, it's always looked with scorn and contempt, that it's to do... Within the end, however much people say it's an illness, they don't really believe it's an illness. They kind of look at it as if you had it strong enough, well, you wouldn't drink. And the way you're talking to me is if I have a strong enough, well, I don't drink. But actually, I think all of us have addictive traits.
Yeah.
All of us have things that we don't and can't choose not to do, and we'd rather not do. And I think how we change is having a deep awareness of them and recognizing that the addiction, you know, people say it's not the addiction, it's what's the pain, what is it being used, and it could be addiction to work. People are often work addicts. I'm probably a work addict. Maybe you're a work addict.
I was always called the skiver when I was young, you know, sort of 4 or 5.
But that may make you a work addict now.
Yeah, and it flipped, and I can't understand that.
You can't understand it?
Well, I mean, you just explained it. How you have such a flip. I used to spend all my energies when I was 7 or 8 or 9 not weeding the drive or washing up, whatever I was told to do. And now, I love it. I just really love working, weeding the drive.
Because it means you're a good girl.
Is that what it is? What do you mean? Are there just two types, good girls and bad girls?
No. But your belief system is informed by your experience. Your
yes.
experience as a child was I was a skiver and I was bad because I wouldn't weed, I wouldn't wash up, I wouldn't make my bed. And so, of course, there's many more aspects of it because we're not simplistic. You know, you flip from A to B. But there will be a part of you, and there's this model called internal family systems, there'll be a part of you that is the young bunny.
Yes.
That is a little bit satisfied and a little bit pleased that she is being the good girl.
I think it was because when my parents were divorcing, before they divorced, I said to my mother, why don't you leave him? Because, you know, it was like bedlam and fights. And she said, well, I couldn't because we'd never have enough money to live on. So I thought that, I remember that click switch in my brain, age probably 12, 10, 12, thinking I'm going to do a job that I really enjoy so I never have to depend on someone else's for my security. And that was what it was.
That's
and
your
so
big I motivation.
Yeah, that was my motivation. And I met quite a few people like that. That so they, yeah. And it's
a big decision.
It's a big decision, but it's a very satisfying one once you know it, doesn't it? Because then you try and find out what you like to do, and then you work down that route. And it's a slow path that you spend the rest of your life doing, possibly.
Yeah,
yeah. As you have done, really.
Exactly.
But you started off, I remember... You did secretarial in Oxford, didn't you, I think, when we were farming near Oxford.
I came and stayed with you.
I think you did.
I do remember.
You did. Yes.
You had a farmhouse.
That's right. And Kevin was a farmer in those days.
Yes.
Gosh, that was
I asked
bad.
Myself to stay. I stayed a couple of nights.
Did you have to ask yourself? Gosh, and then we kicked you out or you left
no,
in disgust.
No, not at all. I think I came for the weekend.
Yeah, I yes. And that was, and then from there, having done secretarial, you went to France. Did you go to France?
I went to secretarial for when I was 17. Then I went to Paris to learn French and had a horrible time at the Alliance Française because men were putting their hands up my skirt and sort of down my front. So
I have to say, you still are, but you were extremely attractive. I mean, all of you.
But also, I was a child. I was 17. It's like...
Yes.
Anyway, and I mean, what amazes me is that I had the kind of balls to look up jobs in the Herald Tribune. I rang up Revlon Cosmetics, went and had an interview, and I got a job in Neuilly. I used to get the metro to Neuilly. And all the other secretaries looked after me like I was a child, which I was, and they did my job for me. Because I couldn't do any of it.
You had the Guinness charm, obviously.
And they took me out for lunch. They helped teach me French.
Oh, lovely.
They put nail varnish on me all the time. I'd never had nail varnish. I never worn it since either, to be fair. I had a really nice time.
Oh, so, and then you became an interior designer?
Then I worked in publishing. So I scammed myself into a job again. I worked at Chatham Windows for the managing director until I got married. And then I had Natasha very quickly. So I had Natasha when I was 21 after I got married. Then I went and did 2 more A-levels. Westminster Tutors, and then I started a decorating business.
Right, and I suppose what will people will wonder is when you had this amazing husband, family, why you decided to then start the career path in psychotherapy. So what made you do that?
I think it was that early decision that I was 21, I had a daughter and I had the ambition and I always wanted to work and how it came to decorating was because I was decorating our house after we got married and I really enjoyed it, and so then I went and worked for a friend in a shop in the King's Road, Sheridan Duffin and Arva's shop, our cousin, distant cousin. And I really enjoyed it. And actually, there isn't an enormous difference between decorating and being a psychotherapist, in the sense that you're listening to people, you're getting inside their mind, you're learning what they like and what they want. And I think the leap into psychotherapy was from going to AA.
Right.
Because I suddenly realised that people could talk about how they felt, and it was a world that I find interesting.
Fascinating. People will know you because of your friendship with the late Princess Diana, and you were great friends, and you went to concerts and things. And she helped coach you for your first speech for Child Bereavement UK.
She did.
Yes.
And she took me out to get my first outfit for it. Yeah. Oh. Not more my kind of what to wear. Yeah.
What did you wear for it?
I wore a blue suit.
Oh, very nice, very nice. With your garden here, I mean, we're sitting in this most beautiful courtyard, which is from the original 17th, built in the 1700s, and then the house was burnt down, and then the Luttians and Jekyll, well, they did the house, and Gertrude Jekyll did the gardens. But this is the original part with sort of colonnades of stone pillars, which are really beautifully done, aren't they, in ashlar stone, with three-centred arches all the way around the edge. It's just an idyllic space because it's not too big. It's quite cosy.
It's quite intimate.
Isn't it? Quite an intimate little cloister, almost.
It is a cloister. We call it the cloister.
But it's not a religious building in any way. But it was just designed like this in the 1700s.
Yeah.
And then you filled it with these box parterres in a crisscross fashion with lots of bright red tulips. And a few standard boxes. It is such a beautiful approach to the back of the house, really. It's just the back door, but everybody uses the back.
So I don't fully understand. So the front, no one uses the front door because the drive comes into the courtyard from the back.
In previous years, when the horse and carriage days, they would have come to the front, presumably, would they?
I don't know. Because I don't know the garden. I don't know if the garden was different.
Yeah.
Because some of the landscaping is still from the house before it was burnt down.
Yes.
I think in some ways, this with the portico and the front door is meant to be the entrance to the house. Because when you step, the thing I love about Luttians is his use of space and design that I think is very psychologically and emotionally holding and also fascinating. So that you come from a large space in the courtyard, you then come through this space, which is narrower, and then you walk up the steps and through the door into this quite narrow, but also very beautifully designed entrance, and then a very narrow staircase. And almost like, I mean, it sounds strange, but it feels a bit like it's a birth canal where you kind of then get thrown into another beautiful space with a barrel ceiling, and then you step into the hall that then has this triple space of height, so that you feel kind of safe as you come in, and then you get excited, wild as you, and also as you move through the house, you have this sense of containment when you go from space to space. And I think, you know, I read quite a lot about his life, and he had this very troubled marriage. He was quite psychologically, in some ways, very immature. He's like a sort of 8-year-old in his humour. And yet he could draw these and have control over these incredible designs and lines that gave him a sense of absolute structure and safety and order.
And then he had obviously this fantastic relation with Gertrude Jekyll, who would do the soft parts. And I wonder how they would have laid this out originally, whereas you've got your pattern box parterres. Do you think this would have been something similar? Or do you ever look at oldmaps.org?
We have got the drawings. We got them from the University of Berkeley, in California.
Oh, right, yes.
I looked at them so long ago, I actually can't remember what was here.
Mm.
I don't know if it certainly wouldn't be box, would it? It would have been more likely if it was going to be flowers. It would have been.
It could have been box. In the 18th century, they might well have used box, yeah. And they wouldn't have had the blight then.
So this is early 19. So this is built in 1927.
Oh, 19. Yeah, could well be. So I was thinking that the cloisters, I thought, were further.
The older, but if you're thinking about Gertrude Jekyll, she worked here 27 to say 29. The house was finished in 27.
Right, lovely. And then it's the site of the house is amazing, isn't it? The way that it's elevated and then it looks down over these amazing sort of river valleys and parkland. And is it called the Daiquiri, the Folly? On the so you look across up to a Daiquiri.
No, that's the Folly. That's called the Temple.
The Temple. And that's where, when we came for lunch years ago, where everyone went up there for drinks before lunch. Yes, that is lovely. So what is the Daiquiri?
Daiquiri is a cottage that's at a different place.
Because they mentioned that. I just looked it up about the house before we came because I couldn't remember exactly what it was like. And I thought it was strange that they just mentioned the Daiquiri. So is that a cottage of significance?
It's a cottage.
Oh, right. Just a nice name. It's a lovely name, isn't it? The Daiquiri. Maybe it was ducks there originally.
Oh, there definitely would have been, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Is obviously it's more your husband's,
much more
his domain. His domain. But how do you use the garden?
I use it all the time. So I use it. My relationship with the garden goes very deep. So when I'm in the house, and I'm looking out at the garden at sunrise, at sunset, in different weathers, it gives me enormous sense of pleasure and peace, and also the sort of space I find incredibly psychologically calming. But then when I walk in it, I walk in it early in the morning with the dog, I walk in it between sessions with clients, I walk in it when I'm writing my books to try and think, and I sit in it to read and research. And so it has kind of very different ways into me. But basically, it's one of kind of deep appreciation, and the different seasons are not so different from our different moods, the colours, and the way. And also, it's a way of kind of appreciating my husband, what he's done, and the work he's put into it. So I find it emotionally, and the beauty of it and nature. I don't believe in an organised religion, but I do have a kind of sense of Gaia. And that nature is, like this time of year, the spring, does feel like absolute, like there is a God in some way when you see the blossom coming, when you see the colour coming after the dark winter and all the rain that we've had. Mm. And now suddenly you have bright tulips. It does feel spiritual in some way. So it matters to me enormously, but I am unbelievably ignorant.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's the effect of just seeing the green on your mind and psyche is extraordinary. And they did that experiment, didn't they, with hospitals. And looked out onto stone concrete walls, some looked out onto
foliage.
They
did much better.
Yeah, and they got much better. So there's definitely something in there, isn't there? And when you work at your desk or your computer, do you look out?
I look out.
You don't find it too distracting? No, it's just it's just amazing.
But I see the kites flying.
Yeah, so you've got lots of red kite here.
Yeah.
Too many or
no.
not?
Oh, right. So when I write, I don't look out. So I sit in the sitting room with my laptop on my lap and I look inwards. But when I'm thinking about what I write,
you look up.
I go outside.
Mm. Oh, you go out,
and often it gives me ideas. Or I cycle through, cycle paths and things. Mm. And so I think I get ideas and creativity and imagination and flow and a sense of openness by being outside that releases me. And then I kind of take that in and I sit down and I kind of try and put it into order.
Mm. And if I've got a problem, I find, and I'm stuck with a design or writing a piece, I'll go outside, thrash around, look at. And your mind appreciates what's there and it takes your mind off the imminent problem. But at the same time, you seem to be working away at it subconsciously. You come back in and then it fits hopefully all back together, doesn't it?
I mean, there's enormous evidence about moving in nature is more beneficial than, say, just moving, running on a running machine in a gym. Mm. And, you know, the area that I am known for, although it's not all that I work in, is grief. And certainly one of the things that I would say to any client or to any webinar is, you know, grief is immensely physiologically and psychologically painful. It's embodied. And if people feel it in their kind of, like, they feel like their heart is broken, or they feel like this crater, yeah, this emptiness inside. Mm. And that they feel completely paralyzed by it, like frozen or terrified. Grief often feels like fear.
Yes.
And so the thing I say that, you know, literally the first thing to do, however awful you're feeling and however awful the weather, get outside and move your body. Because it shifts the cortisol. So cortisol is the fight, flight, freeze state, in a heightened state where your wise mind isn't online. And you then get caught in your own cycles of fear where you get stuck and you can terrorize yourself.
So cortisol, if I was chased by a bull, I would produce cortisol and that would help you run. And it's the same when you have a trauma. You know, that cortisol is eating at your body, as it were.
Well, it's not eating, it's flowing. And it puts, it's your threat system, which is your early evolutionary system to keep you alive.
Yeah.
It goes online because you're the person that you love significantly feels like a threat that they're no longer here.
Mm.
So it feels like a massive threat.
Right.
And so the work of it is to allow yourself to feel the pain, and through experiencing and expressing the pain, you do over time accommodate it and come to heal. And one of the ways...
What do you do? Then the cortisol, though. So when you go outside and you move outside, is it the vagus nerve that helps to take the cortisol?
So the moving your body tells your body you're flying.
Right.
So it tells your body you've done the flight.
Right.
So the cortisol drops.
Oh, I see.
And the dopamine and the oxytocin come online. And the vagus nerve...
That calms you, the dopamine and the oxytocin. Right, I see.
So then you have more thinking capacity and your wise mind. So, like you said, you find unconsciously you solve a problem.
Yeah.
So when you're in a heightened state, all you can see is the problem and you see more problems.
Yeah.
When you're moving and shifting your body, you then actually remember, well, actually, the last time I had a problem like this, I did that, and that worked. Or maybe I could talk to so-and-so, and they can tell me. So you open up
avenues.
Your memory, your library of experiences, which are completely offline when you're in a heightened state. Your library of knowledge, wisdom, experience, that then you can call on to inform you, to help you solve the problem or make better decisions or manage yourself.
Fascinating, because so often when people have a massive trauma, grief, the tendency is to sit in a darkened room, isn't it, and to shut down totally. And for people who aren't outside people, who aren't into gardening, how do you encourage them, or do you get them to go psych? How do you actually, because when you're in that state, it's quite difficult to get the impetus. How do you give them the impetus to make them do that, or encourage them to do that?
You know, there's two things I say. One is just go for 5 minutes. So don't make it a big, make it a small, very manageable step. Just go outside for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Walk around the block, come back. You'll notice you feel better.
Yeah.
And the other thing I say is JFDI. Just friggin' do it.
Just friggin' do it. JFDI. Yeah. We should say that a lot to ourselves more often. Yes.
Because, well, it doesn't take that much to develop a new habit.
No. Yeah.
So you can do it by time of day, you can do it by feeling, you can do it by place. And so that's a hook. So if you say to yourself, I'm going to go for a walk before breakfast every day. So you wake up, you don't say to yourself, shall I go for a walk? It's like you get up and you've got your trainers on before you've even had a chance to think about it.
Yeah.
So, yes. And then you give yourself a treat after you've done them.
No, that's fascinating. You took me on a wonderful tour of the garden and showed me proudly your lovely, all your wonderful plants and vegetables in the greenhouse. It's all beautifully controlled and looked after, isn't it? It looks really apple pie order. But at the same time, you've got that whole more natural movement in the parkland. So you're making those much wilder.
Wild meadows.
Lovely. And do you graze those normally? Or I didn't see any stock
cows.
It's been so wet, I suppose.
No, we've still got the cows. They're absolutely mullering the fields at the moment because it's been so wet.
So wet, yeah. And then you've got lots of beautiful lilac in bloom and viburnums. It's a stunning time of year. Would you say this is the best time of year for the garden?
Well, I mean, or I love spring because it's emergent, you know. Yes. And if you're a therapist, you always love emergent because it's like new, it's like effervescent and exciting.
Yes.
But actually, the summer is really beautiful too.
Yes.
I like winter. So, I mean, I love England because we have seasons, and I love the garden when there's no flowers on the tree, when everything's underground. I love the bareness. I kind of like the space and that you can see much further. I like the cold. I like weather, and I appreciate the garden. And autumn, I think, is a really underappreciated season.
And I think they've got the timing just right for the four very different seasons. And as each new one comes in, you think, wow, don't you? And if
so
it was
exciting.
Any shorter, you'd say, oh, no, but it's just the right length, I think. And I love it. And I even love January and February.
So
now.
Do I.
Yeah, I think they're just such crisp times, and you feel like new things are coming and I can get on and do new projects and things like that. Just back to leaving gardens for a second and going back to the therapy. I have never managed therapy or had any therapy or anything because I'm...
Such an interesting word, I've never managed therapy.
Well,
I've never
managed to do it. Like, so I've never managed... I always think... But you must... I just think you must have people like me. I don't think it's in my upbringing or anything like that. It's just that if I have a problem, I like to work it through myself. And when I asked Kevin, my husband, what he thought of it. And he's obviously had a pretty awkward childhood. He was, when they picked
bereaved
him up as a child, yes, he was apparently rocking and took him away to stay with someone else because his mother obviously couldn't cope. So he's had a real belly full. But he said, oh, well, that's just what life throws at you and you get on and get up. But do you think that is actually counterproductive? Or do you think that people who find their own way, you think, well, that's fine. They do it their way. I do it my way. Or
I really don't think therapy is a panacea for all else. I think when people find ways of being that work for them, and that would mean not using therapy, that is a really valid way of being. The only question I would add is that if you have no dialogue with someone who is challenging your ways of thinking and the story you tell yourself about yourself, you can have quite a narrow story about yourself and you can have quite fixed views. And so those that are very close to you may challenge them, but you're not open enough or have the awareness enough to be willing to explore them. Because your way of coping is
rigid.
I mean, it doesn't have to be rigid, but it's more. It's less flexible.
Flexible, yeah.
Because you've had to hold on to these pillars. Like, I'm fine. I sort myself out. You know, we all have to face these things.
Yeah.
And so, someone who isn't doing that may look at you, and maybe that's your response to them, and you can't fully hear that they need something different.
Yeah. I mean, I could never quite understand it after living with him for God knows what, almost 50 years.
Does he mind you talking about him, by the way? Does he ever listen to your podcast?
He never listens to it. He never listens to it. But it was interesting because he always likes meals on time. And that's been, you know, even if something
but
radical
But that would be
happens,
predictable because Mairead was never predictable.
I've only just twigged that because he never had meals on time before. And I've only just realised, sorry, Julia, obviously that's why. Because he likes it. That really is thick of me, isn't it? I'm really sorry for all those years of not being more understanding about that. Yes. But on the other hand, it's good for him to start to flex. And if it has to be late every so often, he just has to sort of...
Mutter.
And then he'll have it a bit later or stomp off and say, well, I'm not having lunch today or whatever. Yeah. That's interesting. When I have a bad time, I do all my invoicing, which I absolutely loathe, and I'm so relieved when I've done it that I feel better.
He's a qualified accountant, doesn't he?
I know, but I have to write them. I have to say what he has to do. Yeah, he's a qualified accountant now, which is jolly useful. Poor man, I think he's finding it very hard. Well, I used to do my own VAT and things, and then he said, for God's sake, I could do the VAT for BP in the time that you do yours. So he very kindly took it over. But no, it's fascinating. And I have to say, it's extraordinary how you've sort of, they always say that generations pass on the same things on and on, but you appear to have kicked that, don't you? You've kicked the alcoholism. Obviously, you haven't taken that on. You've got a really well-functioning family life.
Well, I mean, you can hear me muttering. I mean, I think all families, and mine as well, move on the spectrum as functioning and dysfunctioning, depending on what's going on externally and internally.
They can be pretty weird.
There is no way I am this model of, like, high-functioning family. Mm. I think we are, like, hopefully the majority of families. We try hard. We make absolutely massive mistakes. Mm. We get cross with each other. Over time, we make up with each other. And, you know, we are a good enough family. So I think it would be totally false to kind of make out that I've got everything sorted.
Because I don't think anyone ever has. Exactly. No one ever totally. And you never know. The only thing you know in life is you're going to have change, and you don't know whether it's good or bad, and you just have to go with it somehow and cope with it.
The source of my middle book, This Too Shall Pass.
Oh, right. Mm. Is it? Mm. Yes. But no, that's fascinating. Thank you very much. Well, I always give my guest a present. And so I bought you a box. A box of goodies from Time. It's the Bertarelli collection. Do you know the Time Hotel?
Wonderful,
near Lechlode?
Yes.
And Bertarelli do this lovely meadow mint. And so we've got this lovely candle, mint soap, which is beautiful. You can use in your hair or your face. Anyway, it's really lovely creamy soap. Moisturisers, a whole box that you can just relax.
Luxury.
Thank you. They really smell. It's from, they have lovely water meadows there with lots of wild mint in, and that's the inspiration that Karen Hibbert took the range from. And Bertarelli is her father's family name.
Wonderful.
So very I hope romantic. You enjoy them and you relax in your while looking at your lovely garden.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julia. Lovely
Thank you,
to chat.
Lovely.